You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The numbers are in, and despite constant warnings about California's drought, people across the state are actually using more water this year than last. Angst over water is nothing new around these parts, but usually it's involving farmers complaining about environmentalists or vice versa. But this year, it's often neighbor against neighbor as residents seek to conserve water, turning off the sprinklers and letting yards go brown. The result is sometimes resentment. One neighbor complains about the other's leaky sprinklers or about the unsightly landscaping, even posting pictures to social media, calling out the offending party. It's been dubbed drought shaming, and it's our topic this hour on Valley Edition. Joining us now, we have freelance journalist and community college professor Jefferson Beavers, who has written about this issue on his blog. Jefferson, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
And Mark Standriff. He's a spokesperson for the city of Fresno, which has instituted new outdoor watering restrictions effective this Friday. Mark, welcome.
It's great to be on, Joe. Thanks.
Jefferson, I want to start with you. What's the conversation been like in your Fresno neighborhood? Do you have neighbors who are looking afoul of their fellow neighbors and their sprinklers or their lawns?
I think that my neighborhood is it's in East Central Fresno. It's a kind of working class neighborhood, and it's probably like a microcosm of what you would see anywhere else in the state. There's about maybe a third of the neighbors who've let their lawns go brown. The rest of them are still watering business as usual. And I think that my wife and I have been among the first to kind of let our sprinklers die and our lawn go brown. It's been about 3 years now. And we've faced a lot of shaming for letting our lawns go brown. But now, of course, it's the tide is turning and folks are, you know, calling out folks who are maybe overwatering.
How is that shaming materialized? What's that like?
It's just a lot of small comments like, oh, that's what you're doing with your lawn, or oh, I noticed that there's this dirt over here. It's pretty dusty out here these days, and you know, it's usually pretty indirect. But now I think it's again that tide's turning where you know you see the perfectly green putting greens, and you kind of wonder, hey, that's an awful lot of water you're using over there.
Do you think this? Speaks to the often prickly relationship neighbors can sometimes have, and
sure.
Is this making that worse in any way?
I think it is. One of the things that about you know just calling it drought shaming is it really does pit a person against person, and I think that's the big downside to it. I think the more perhaps the more progressive way to think about it would be to start to reimagine what our green spaces look like. There's lots of drought-tolerant, water-wise plants that are available. If there was perhaps some more assistance, especially in poorer and working-class neighborhoods, to help convert those lawns, I think that would be a much more constructive conversation to be having rather than, hey, let's call in so-and-so down the block for watering their sidewalk.
And this has been something that people have been talking about statewide, turning to online and our Twitter followers. We got a tweet from Danielle in Fresno. She said, my neighbors are actually, she said, anyone else getting drought shame for not watering their lawn enough? My neighbor gave us grief for our yellowish lawn. My neighbor said reducing watering doesn't make much difference for conservation. Mark, turning to you now, the city of Fresno introduced new restrictions on outdoor residential watering last week. They take effect Friday. What are those restrictions and why is the city making those moves?
Well, and I think the most important thing for everybody to understand is that the city of Fresno has been a leader in water conservation for 20 years. Back in 1994, we instituted really the first imposed restrictions in the state. In fact, we got a little bit of ridicule for it. They felt like we were getting a little too defensive about our water situation. That's when we went to 3 days a week watering. So the new plan that's in place that starts on Friday is actually the only change is you're losing a day of watering. So it goes from instead of 3 days a week, 2 days a week. So if you have an address that's odd numbered, it's Tuesdays and Saturdays. Even numbered, it's Wednesdays and Sundays. No watering, obviously, Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays. But all the other restrictions, including the hours, like after 6 before 7 a.m., other things like a series of warnings are fine. Still the same thing that we've been doing for the last 20 years.
So what is the enforcement part of this? How does that work? Is there a ramped up enforcement effort, and how do you have neighbors calling in other neighbors, reporting them to the city water cops, or is there somebody driving around looking for sprinklers that are going on the wrong day on the wrong side of the street?
Well, I certainly want to thank the Fresno Bee for coining the phrase water cops, because that's not really what our conservation representatives are all about. Yes, are they part of enforcement? Absolutely. But for the most part, what they're doing is, and these are folks that they're on a schedule that actually goes 7 days a week, because, you know, water is obviously the lifeblood of our valley. And we want to make sure that people out there are not only aware of possible overwatering issues, but are also aware of the potential for them to learn more about. And this goes back to what Jefferson was saying about different neighborhoods understanding that there are, you know, more plants that are more indigenous to the Central Valley that might be more drought resistant, rather than using the typical kind of Midwest or East Coast horticultural plan, grasses that are a little hardier. And these are folks that know everything about that and can go to your house and say, okay, you know, we've gotten a complaint from somebody. And again, they remain anonymous. But from that standpoint, you know, we understand that you might be watering a little bit. Do you understand? Do you have problems with your irrigation system? So they can actually, you know, they can help you program if you're having problems with your individual system as well, replacing broken sprinkler heads. They'll even go out there and start working with commercial and industrial firms too to talk about some of the technology that's out there to be able to go smarter. You know, the interesting thing, and I'm sorry if I go on, but the interesting thing that we're finding in this whole drought shaming thing is that a lot of places like golf courses and cemeteries are getting a lot of negative attention for having green fields and fairways. And yet they're stuck in kind of a no-win situation because the people that frequent those places want to see green, especially around, let's say, Grandma Doris's gravesite. So letting that go brown isn't necessarily an option for them. But you'll find that the people who are in charge of those things are probably the most frugal and the most interested parties when it comes to how much they're actually spending to the water. They'll tell you down to the drop how much they're spending. So they're being conscious about it, but I think everybody's just got to be responsible.
I should say that these restrictions are unique to Fresno, but they are not entirely unique because statewide cities have been required to step up their enforcement to this level two in Bakersfield. Our listeners there know that the city made a decision last week to close down 9 splash parks early for the summer. They'll close this week, I believe. And the cities throughout the valley are doing this. Is the city of Fresno doing the $500 fines that the state is?
No. And then, unfortunately, people tended to overreact when they heard $500. They thought it was like an automatic ticket if somebody catches you, you know, hosing down your driveway or washing your car, you know, in a big block party. Our fine system is set up so that you get a warning the first time. After that, it's more consultation and a $45 fine. That can continue on for 4 more $45 fines until the city actually has the option to shut off water. Let me just tell you, though, that's only in extreme circumstances. And when I say extreme, let me tell you about the last time the city of Fresno actually shut off somebody's water. It was a gentleman who was absolutely adamant about building a moat around his house. So you really have to go way, way out there. But again, what we're trying to do is we're not out there trying to be water cops. The city of Fresno is out there to try to help people understand that you don't necessarily – watering two days a week doesn't have to be a death sentence for your lawn. If we can help you find ways to irrigate smarter and better, if we can give you opportunities to figure out how your system works and how it can work in conjunction with your neighbors, and more importantly, what other options are out there for you, rather than imposing a bunch of fines and seeming like a bunch of brown shirts.
I want to turn now to another guest we have on the phone with us, Felicia Marcus. She's from the State Water Resources Control Board. Felicia, how are communities throughout the state dealing with this? Is there a great variety or a difference in ways that communities are dealing with this problem?
Oh, it's as varied as the state. I mean, you have some communities that have gone so far as to do landscape ordinances that essentially are saying that their climate's not appropriate really for Midwestern lawns. That would be at one end of the spectrum. There are others who have gone to very aggressive rate structures or what are called allocation-based rates, where they've said, here's the average or the reasonable amount of water that a given household, you know, depending on how many people you have, should need, and here's what's reasonable for your landscaping. And if you use more, the rates go up dramatically. You have a variety of outdoor and indoor irrigation, or indoor use and outdoor irrigation rules. Mm-hmm. Some communities have been aggressively using rebates as well as regulation over the past 20 years to get toilet retrofits and mm-hmm. Appliance upgrades, et cetera, or even in Los Angeles and other Southern California communities, there are pretty aggressive turf buyout programs so they can help ease the cost of redoing one's yard to a drought-tolerant yard. So it really varies.
What would be the next step beyond beyond the rules that the Water Resources Board implemented earlier this month? What would be the next step? Was it stage three, and how much more draconian would that be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we're hoping these rules just take effect. I think they took effect yesterday afternoon, which was a few days sooner than we thought. And the goal of these was really to ring the bell and get communities that hadn't yet stepped up to mandatory outdoor irrigation to do so. There was a lot of focus on the fines, as Mark said, as if immediately you got a $500 ticket. That was a tool in the toolkit, and the progressive education approach is something that we think is a good idea as well. But the piece that people missed was that having agencies upgrade their drought contingency plans, implement the ones that had some kind of mandatory outdoor irrigation, or there's a $10,000 fine per day for agencies. So our target was getting the agencies to step up more than individuals, but we thought the individual norms were important as well, just to get it across to people that we were in a drought. In many respects, our target was much of urban California that's hundreds of miles away from their water source, and they wouldn't have known there was a drought. So part of it was to say, hey, guys, it's time to step up. We're all in this together. You have fields going fallow in the Central Valley. You have communities that are running out of water. The least you could do is not overwater your lawn. Now, we're hoping that this is going to yield a lot of progress, and so far, anecdotally, we've gotten a lot of folks who had been resistant agencies saying, okay, we're going to step up. They've set their meetings, or they've already had their meetings to implement their stage, whatever stage it is for them. The PPIC poll came in saying that 75% of Californians want mandatory conservation at the local level, so between our regs and community opinion, we're hoping it's going to be easier for those agencies to step up and take action, and so maybe we won't have to go to the next level. If we go to the next level, it's not just saying stage three. It's any number of things. We may declare certain uses unreasonable in a drought. We might get folks to focus more on leaks. And there's a mm-hmm. whole host of other things we might go to.
Certainly.
But we're trying to get those things that would be communicate to people they needed to act, but not force people to spend a lot of money or do something outside the norm of what many agencies are already doing.
Thank you so much, Felicia. Jefferson, I want to turn back to you because you posted about this issue of drought shaming last week on your blog. Mm-hmm. And in your case, you were not talking about your neighbors. You were talking about the city of Fresno and Cary Park, which is near your home on Augusta
right.
Avenue, right behind Fashion Fair. What did you see?
Basically, this summer, as I've been walking early mornings, super early, 5 a.m. before dawn, I'd noticed that the park was getting watered pretty much every day for close to a full hour on weekdays. And that was resulting in, puddling in the actual park itself. There's some sprinkler heads that were spraying into the street. One sprinkler head in particular was busted. And so, I had kind of just accepted this as a fact of life in our neighborhood. This park has always been a super lush green park. Of course, it serves a wide range of people in that area. As Mark mentioned, people expect those types of spaces to be green. But when the Stage 2 announcement came out, I thought, well, maybe this is a time that I need to speak up and say something about that and not just accept it as, business as usual. And so at this point, that's when I produced several posts last week, two this week, and one this, about some photographs and a video showing the actual watering of the street, puddling what I think is really overwatering. And again, my whole thinking was, I don't really believe that drought shaming is a solution to this. I think you're a neighbor. You should go talk with your neighbor. But at the same time, if the city is asking us to, enact these kinds of things, then it should be taking the lead in making those kinds of re-envisionings and specific adjustments themselves.
Mark, do the new restrictions apply to the city itself?
Absolutely. In fact, the city of Fresno is either the number one or the number two water user, depending on the time of year. And just getting back to, what Jefferson's blog and his posts on social media, from my standpoint, I'm the person who's in charge of kind of monitoring what's going on. I happened to see his Twitter post on the issue, contacted him directly, went out and just let the folks in Public Works know that there was an issue on Cary Park. We thought we had it taken care of, but Jefferson again stepped forward and said that, the leak seems to be back. So now I've got to reach out to Public Works again this morning and let them know it, because it seems that the problem is a little bit more than just some sort of a surface fix. But let me get to the whole thing about drought shaming, and certainly about the city of Fresno being leading by example. From the very moment that the State Water Resources Control Board made their announcement, we were out there and trying to let people know that, it's important for us to know when issues like this are happening. If you're seeing a sprinkler shooting straight up in the air, if you're seeing a leaky, sidewalk concrete fixture, if you're seeing puddles showing up, or where irrigation dripping bare strips of dirt, you need to let us know. And it's probably just as important to let us know as directly as you can, as quickly as you can, so we can get the problem fixed.
And you have a city hotline. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, even with neighbors. Do you talk to your neighbor about the problem, or do you post something on social media saying, hey, the person two doors down has got the sprinkler going? You chose to blog about this.
That's right.
Did you call 621 City and report this first? Or
the initial call, I did call the city, and it seemed like a little bit of a confusing maze to get through. Now, there's another number that's been put out in recent days that it's a more specific number. I don't know where that number goes to, but the main city number to me is a little confusing. I know it's meant to be a one-stop shop, but just as a resident, one try in that felt confusing. And so then I said, well, I don't know if I have the patience to go through this, this phone tree and series of messages. So that's when I took to Twitter.
And the 621 City line, as Jefferson mentioned, is a one-call shop. These are folks that have, big pages of FAQs that they want to need to go through.
Sure.
That's why we established a line, 621-5380. That's the direct line that goes right to our water conservation department, lets us know where those problems are. They immediately notify Public Works. And then, of course, the issue is the city of Fresno has over 1,300 irrigation systems, that we've got to try to monitor it. And again, that's why it's important. The issue of drought shaming, and specifically on social media, I don't know if you gentlemen agree with this, but there's also a certain amount of self-indulgence that kind of goes with people kind of, throwing things out on Twitter or Instagram or whatever and hoping that the world sees it. Fortunately, you get the right set of eyes on it, especially when the city's involved, and we can take care of those things. But our feeling is always we need to lead by example. So, we're urging people out there, if you're going to narc on anybody, narc on the city.
Well, it's very interesting indeed, and we'll certainly be following this as it continues. We certainly hope the weather turns around and we have another wet year, but as Jefferson said, maybe it's time to look at more drought-friendly landscaping throughout the city. Again, Mark Stander, spokesperson for the city of Fresno, and Jefferson Beavers, a journalist and blogger online. He's been blogging about drought shaming online. Jefferson, your website again?
JeffersonBeavers.com.
And Mark, that number one more time?
Is 621-5480.
All right. Thank you both so much for joining us. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about California's next oil boom. It might be a tasty one. Coming up next on Valley Edition.
California Chrome, the colt from Kalinga that won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, was a $10,000 investment that earned his owners $20 million. Now's your chance to run for the roses. Your $60 investment could earn you $10,000 in Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. More information and a downloadable entry form are available at kvpr.org.
And it's a run for the roses, as fast as you can.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, stories of escape.
It's already limited over there for youth. So imagine a youth without papers in Oakland, you know what I mean?
A young immigrant escapes the cycle of crime and dashed hopes through music. That's next time on Latino USA.
Thursday night at 8 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We all know Central California produces most of the state's petroleum, but could another oil boom be on the horizon? Well, that's what journalist Nathaniel Johnson from the online environmental news website Grist argues in a new article that came out last week. But he's not talking about fracking or the Monterey Shale. He's talking about olive oil. He joins us now on Valley Edition. Nathaniel Johnson, welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
Essentially, what you're arguing is that the drought, consumer trends, and some less than scrupulous practices by foreign olive oil importers could, in your view, drive California growers to turn to olives. Why is that?
Well, all those things that you just mentioned. I think the main issue is that olive trees are really good in the kind of climate that we have in the Central Valley. You know, they're a Mediterranean tree. They're built for low water situations. They have these small waxy leaves that resist water transpiration, and they can go dormant when it gets really dry. In most places around the world, they're grown without any irrigation at all. And So farmers all over are starting to put in olive trees in land that they thought was just completely unusable. And so there's the possibility to grow it. And there's also, it seems like people are waking up to the possibility of eating more of it. So there's a market growing out there.
Yes, indeed. And we're joined also in our studio by Robert Rocha. He's from Enzo Olive Oil, a local artisanal olive oil producer from Madera County. Robert, welcome.
Thank you, and good morning.
And now olives are certainly a crop that's been grown here in the San Joaquin Valley for well over 100 years.
That's correct.
Your family has been in, or the family company has been involved with olives for years. What do you see as the outlook for local olive oil producers? Is this something that is picking up steam? Because it's kind of had ups and downs. We had the Lindsay olives. That was a big thing.
Right.
And I remember Al Radka and the Oberti olive commercial in Madera years ago. But it kind of seems like it went away for a while, but now the olive oil industry is coming back, I guess.
When you look at the olive production in California, there's been a major shift out of the fresh olives into the planting the varieties for olive oil. So adapting, what we're talking about here is adapting, right, to conditions that we have now, which is the drought and less water to deal with. So farmers now, and that's why the Ricciuti family decided to go into planting the olives a few years back and getting production, it's making that change out of certain crops into others that take less water, like Nathaniel brought up. So when we decided, it was a couple reasons. We saw the need for a good extra virgin oil in the market that we know that's not there right now on the grocery shelves. And we know there needs to be more of that production. And that's what we decided to plant enough and go organic as well. But yeah, definitely it was a decision we made both because of adapting, making changes, and also it's labor. Fresh olives takes a lot of labor to pick the olives. When you get to our production now and we set up with a super high density train, then you can mechanically harvest. Big difference in cost.
There's a lot of talk this year about the way water is used in the state. Almonds are the big cash crop right now. You see, even in the middle of the drought, almond orchards going in now because the profits are absolutely huge and the demand keeps growing and growing and growing. How do your trees deal with drought? Because almonds take a fair bit
and
of water.
Our biggest commodity is almonds. So our biggest commodity, and I'm glad Nathaniel put that in his article there about loving almonds, and thank you. So because almonds are healthy. They're good. And that's what continues to grow worldwide, the demand for almonds. And so that's a good thing. But they do take more water. And like says an article, it is about twice as much water that they do take. So and almonds cannot go without the water, right? So olive trees can go into dormancy. So they can shut down and they can get through those periods and then kind of come back out of it. Now, almonds, no. So what's happening now is there's definitely, as people are running out of water, don't have the surface water, they're looking at what items to be able to grow. That's where I see they're going to be looking at pistachios has been one, and I believe olives will be another. But we have to make the change in the marketplace because people just don't know about a good extra virgin olive oil, and they're still using this the stuff that's on the shelf that is not good, has no taste, and not good for them. So the education at the consumer level needs to take place. We've got a long ways to go, but we actually have entities that just got established too that's going to help in regards to that, standards and creating demand.
Turning back to you, Nathaniel, that is a big part of this because if you have farmers who can make a lot more money growing almonds, they're probably going to do that. Olive oil demand is up, but on the consumer level, there's some interesting things that are going on there. You talk about it briefly in your piece and mention there's a book, Extra Virgin, that talks about this very interesting and odd world of what exactly is in your olive oil, especially with some of the things that are imported from outside the country. What is the problem there?
Well, the problem is that we're suckers, basically. In the U.S., we get the world's olive oil that's rejected from other places, mm-hmm. And unless you're getting locally grown olive oil, you're often getting the bad stuff. So, and we just haven't. It's not so much part of our culture, so we don't know what good olive oil tastes like. And many people in the United States have never tasted this stuff.
That's right.
Because we're always getting the stuff that the Italians don't want or the Spanish don't want, and much of it is mislabeled and or rancid. So there's all kinds of unscrupulous practices. You know, people bringing in shipments fraudulently. You know, you have these worldwide supply chains, and every stop along the way, there's the possibility of someone to make a little buck by slipping in some soy oil or you know something like that. This is an industry that, at least historically, has really been beset by a lot of fraud. But I'd be interested to hear. I don't know about the changes, and it sounds like Robert, there's some more information that I don't have about the future on that.
Yeah, what's the latest on that, Robert?
Looking better, much better. We are currently right now establishing the standards for California olive oil, which is important to do once we get that set, and the commission has been established for California. And we have people on the board, and we're setting the standards. And because we have the highest levels of standards, California does. And we have a seal. We send our oils in. They get tested, and they're certified extra virgin. So, you know, for the listeners out there, it's important to look at that seal.
And what does extra virgin mean?
Well, that's a great point, Joy, because it is important. And in itself, quickly, is extra virgin is the highest grade of olive oil can be received. It's free of defects or taste flaws and produced without chemicals or extreme heat. Okay? So just know this. A lot of the world cannot produce extra virgin oil because you have to have the right equipment. It has to be milled within hours, so much time that when it's picked, and it can't be damaged. So there's a lot that goes into it. So the investment is high. You take a look at Europe, for instance. The locations of the orchards, getting it to the mill where it gets milled, it can be days. They get behind. They can't keep up. That all affects the quality. So as California, we produce we go for the quality. We go for the top quality, which is extra virgin, which is important, right? We want the consumer to have a top quality. But that definition in itself, and when Nathaniel's talking about, it's just a blatant misrepresentation at the shelf, and it's so wrong. But nobody's really doing anything about it.
The FDA doesn't do anything?
No. But believe me, Pat has been to D.C. with a lot of the other producers, okay? And we're working in Sacramento. We are setting – but we have a battle. It's a David and Goliath deal. There's no doubt about it. These guys are big. It's big money for them. They've had this market. It's a dumping ground is what it is, okay? Because nobody's changing it. we are definitely want to change that. And that's going to be the one of the secrets for our success is getting it marked, right, getting people familiar. So I definitely challenge your listeners out there, go out, taste the fresh oil. There's a few places in Fresno and Clovis. Bella Fruta we sample every day. You can go to Sarah Nut House, Wee Olives in Fig Garden. Go out there, taste it, know what it is, because what we need is you. We need you to demand good olive oil in the restaurants, and Nathaniel brought out in his article, because the restaurants, I think yet to be in a restaurant that serves a good olive oil. So it's important. So getting familiar with it, know what it is, and getting it demanded from the consumer is going to leave that other oil off, leave it on the shelf. Well, it's not going to be sold.
And as Nathaniel says, it could have benefits for California, not only for producers, but for the entire Central Valley. Again, Nathaniel Johnson from the online magazine Grist. You can read his article about California's next oil boom online at grist.org. And also joining us today, Robert Rocha of Enzo Olive Oil, a local artisanal olive oil producer from Madera County. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is Valley Edition.